esa primera línea de fuego. En el frente de Candela, esa primera línea de fuego.
Spain, July 1936. Following a victory for the left-wing Popular Front coalition in the elections earlier in the year, a confederation of army generals have carried out an insurrection in the Spanish Republic. Throughout the year, conflict between fascist and socialist organizations have escalated throughout the country. The conspirators behind the military revolt, who called themselves the Nationalists, claim that they must seize the government to prevent a communist takeover and to restore law and order. But wherever the forces of the insurrection go, mass executions of trade unionists, activists, and government sympathizers follow. The Spanish Civil War would drag on for over 2.5 years. It would devastate the country, leaving hundreds of thousands dead, and the government in the hands of a far-right dictatorship for almost 4 decades. The Nationalists would eventually win the war, of course, but they couldn't do it without help. Over 80,000 volunteer troops from fascist Italy and Nazi Germany would arrive to help the Spanish generals defeat democracy on the battlefield. Most importantly, they would put their machinery of war into the service of Spanish reaction. Italian submarines sank Republican supply ships, and bombers from Nazi Germany's Condor Legion leveled whole cities. But the Nationalists in Spain had the support of another key ally, one that operated in secret and is often forgotten about today. All those submarines, tanks, and planes from the fascist powers needed fuel. They sourced their fuel on full credit, shipped free of charge, from an eager supporter of the far right in Europe, the Texas Company, better known today as Texaco. This is a conspiracy you can believe in. Hello and welcome to Conspiracy You Can Believe In, a show about conspiracies and criminal plots that actually happened. Today, we're talking about the Spanish Civil War. It was a brutal conflict that lasted from 1936 to 1939 and resulted in a far-right regime ruling Spain for almost 40 years. A little-known fact about the war is that the armies of the Nationalists and their allies in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany were supplied by oil from the Texas Company, which you may know today as Texaco. In fact, as we'll hear, Texaco's role went far beyond just providing fuel to the fascist armies. They effectively financed the insurrection and provided vital reconnaissance. You could argue that without help from Texaco, Francisco Franco might not have been able to even win the war. Now, Texaco's role in assisting the Nationalists and the Nazi Air Force was known around the time of the Spanish Civil War, but the extent of their involvement wouldn't fully be realized until decades later, when independent researchers were able to gain access to the records of the Franco regime in a new democratic Spain. I first learned about Texaco's alliance with the fascist powers in a book by Adam Hochschild called Spain in Our Hearts. It's a recent publication about the international community's role in the Spanish Civil War. It includes a few chapters about Texaco's dealings with Franco, and I'm using it as my main source for this episode. It's a great book. You should check it out. And I'm also using the books The Spanish Civil War by the British historian Hugh Thomas and the book The Spanish Republic and the Civil War by Gabriel Jackson. Before we start talking about the alliance between this international petroleum brand and fascists in Europe, I need to give a little background on the Spanish Civil War itself. It's a pretty complicated topic, And at least in the United States, it's not really covered very extensively in your high school history class. But the Spanish Civil War holds an important place in world history. This conflict, just a little over 15 years after the first modern world war, was a prelude to the second one. A tenuous alliance of liberals, socialists, anarchists, and communists found themselves on one side of the line, fighting against a coalition of fascists, monarchists, and reactionaries on the other side. Many leaders of the Spanish Republic warned the rest of Europe that this war would soon come to their own countries if they failed to crush the threat of fascism. But why did this all happen in Spain first? Why was this country the stage of the first act of World War II? Spain, after all, was neutral in World War I. There's no one single answer. But to put it simply, by the start of the Civil War in 1936, Spain was a deeply divided nation. Ever since the Napoleonic Wars, the leaders and people of Spain found themselves in two general camps. Those who looked to progress and a better society in the future, and those who looked to tradition and an ideal world of the past. Throughout the 19th century, bitter civil wars between liberal reformers and conservative monarchists would tear Spain apart. And then, the Spanish-American War in 1898 would see nearly all of Spain's remaining colonies fall into American hands. And a series of grinding guerrilla conflicts in modern-day Morocco would waste Spanish lives and gold for decades in the early 20th century. By 1923, the Spanish military had deposed the Parliament, or Cortes, installing General Miguel Primo de Rivera as dictator. Although Spain was supposed to be a constitutional monarchy, the king, Alfonso XIII, supported this military takeover. In the atmosphere of decline, political differences heightened. The Catholic Church, which held vast economic and political power in Spain, had both its zealous defenders and its anti-clerical opponents. Socialist trade unions began to organize in Spain's mines and cities, and anarchists among the rural farm laborers. By the 20s, far-right organizations would begin to take cues from fascist parties in Italy and Germany. They began using the Roman salute and fighting left-wing rivals in the streets. To make things even more divided, multiple languages are spoken within Spain itself, like Catalan in the northeast and the puzzling Basque language in the mountains of the north. These regions would have parties that demanded varying degrees of independence or autonomy, which put them at odds with those who wanted central control out of Madrid. And it was in this atmosphere that the dictator Primo de Rivera tried to hold the country together. He had little use for democracy. He censored newspapers, and he banned political organizations that opposed him. His focus was on stabilizing Spain by winning the war in Morocco, which he did, and developing the economy through public works, which he did, until the economy crashed in 1929. By the time the Great Depression began, Miguel Primo de Rivera lost any remaining support he had among the Spanish, including his own cabinet. He resigned and moved to Paris, where he died a few months later. The return of power to King Alfonso didn't last much longer. After monarchist parties failed to win majorities in most large cities in the local elections of April 1931, King Alfonso himself resigned and went into exile. The Second Spanish Republic was declared soon after. The first government of the Spanish Republic quickly set about reordering Spanish society. Their new constitution gave women the right to vote. It allowed civil marriage and divorce, and it paved the way for major land reform later on. It also significantly curbed the power of the Catholic Church, one, by secularizing the education system, and two, by severely limiting the ability of the church to own businesses. I have to digress here for a minute to talk about the role of the Catholic Church in Spain at the time. It was an immensely powerful institution that was connected to the old social order, that is, monarchy, and it held a tremendous amount of land as well as many profitable businesses. Many of these were owned through the Jesuit order. Now, keep in mind, this was at a time when there was an intense disparity of wealth in the country and a growing movement for land distribution to the lower classes. Bishops and other church leaders in Spain tended to be extremely right-wing and mistrustful of the new republic, and the new constitution only made them angrier. On the other hand, the republican government was mostly led by anti-clerical liberals from radical parties of the middle class. They had an intense hatred for the liberties that they felt the Catholic Church repressed and its association with the monarchy. Socialists were opposed to the church politically for these reasons as well, but also for the concentrated wealth that the church had amassed in Spain. Most of the intense hatred for the church came from the anarchists, who hated all hierarchies, especially those connected to the old regime. Church burnings and attacks on priests and nuns were pretty common in this era, especially in the areas controlled by the anarchists. Now, Spain may be a Catholic country to this day, but in 1931, only about one-third of Spaniards actually attended Mass. Most people were baptized Catholic. They might get married at a Catholic church, but they were not in any sense religious people. Still, the secular constitution of 1931 would provoke a backlash from the political right, who consolidated into a Catholic political party called the Spanish Confederation of the Autonomous Right, or SEDA in the Spanish acronym. SEDA did very well in the parliamentary elections of 1933. They ran a campaign on traditional values and fear of a secular communist takeover of Spain. The SEDA had a plurality, but they didn't have enough seats to win a clear majority, and most other parties in Spain hesitated to put any of its members in government. Now, although on paper SEDA was a standard Catholic conservative party, they did have some flirtations with fascism. The party chair, José María Gil Robles, attended Nazi rallies in Nuremberg, and he took to holding similar demonstrations of his own. He also took to calling himself jefe, or leader, much like Il Duce in Italy. When some members of SEDA were finally placed in the government a year after the election, it sparked a massive strike and revolt in Asturias in northern Spain. There, a broad coalition of left-wing parties and union miners rose up against the government. In their mind, the young republic was under threat from inside. SEDA was a party with fascist leanings and was openly hostile to the new constitution. Its presence in the government couldn't be tolerated by this left-wing coalition. After the revolt took several barracks and the provincial capital of Asturias, the government swept in and crushed it severely. A mass imprisonment of over 30,000 socialists and anarchists followed, with many leaders of the Socialist Workers' Party ending up in jail. The repression following the Asturias revolt was heavy-handed, and many of those in jail were what we might call political prisoners today. In response to this, the left in Spain began to collaborate on the electoral front. For these elections in 1936, they formed a coalition of parties called the Popular Front. The Popular Front included the Socialists, Regional Nationalists, the relatively small Communist Party, two major liberal parties, and many members of the Anarchist Trade Union. They scored a major victory at the polls in February 1936. Although they narrowly won the popular vote against the right-wing coalition in the overall vote, the Popular Front gained a total majority in Parliament. The right in Spain responded to this with shock, horror, and in some cases, violence. Hundreds of people were shot in the months following the 1936 election, mostly in clashes between socialists and gangs of Falangists, members of Spain's fascist party. The new government made good on some of the promised reforms, like getting amnesty for people jailed after the Asturias revolt and a substantial land redistribution. But even though the president and prime minister of the new republic were well-established politicians from liberal parties, many leaders of the right wing accused the Popular Front of ushering in a communist takeover. Because of the zealously Christian character of the Spanish far right, these accusations often became anti-Semitic and conspiratorial, charging that the left-wing government was a Jewish or Freemason plot. Soon after the Popular Front was voted in, a small group of reactionary generals began to conspire to overthrow it. General Emilio Mola was a conservative military officer from a noble family. In the chaotic months following the victory of the new left-wing government, Mola forged connections with traditionalists, military leaders, and fascists throughout Spain. They planned to organize a coup. A previous military takeover of the Republic was attempted in 1932 by General José Sanjurjo, but this time Mola wanted to be more prepared. He brought in Sanjurjo and a popular general from the Moroccan Wars, Francisco Franco, as his co-conspirators. The insurgency put the plan into action in July of 1936, when the right-wing military officers revolted in the town of Melilla in Spanish Morocco. They quickly captured the local government and began executing Republican supporters. The rebellion quickly spread, with General Mola spreading his forces from his base in the north and Franco moving his forces from Africa into mainland Spain and moving across the south. Keep in mind, although Spain was bitterly divided politically, the Popular Front did win the last election. So wherever they went, the Nationalists, as they were soon to be called, found plenty of people who opposed them. Franco and Mola's armies dealt with them swiftly and mercilessly. In the Nationalist zone of control, any trade unionist, activist, or even voters for the Popular Front were in serious danger of being killed by the military or by death squads from the Falange. The Falange was the Spanish Fascist Party, which allied itself with the Nationalist forces. And all of this was the official policy of the Nationalist leaders. General Mola said himself, quote, "It is necessary to create an atmosphere of terror. Anyone who is overtly or secretly a supporter of the Republic must be shot." And they were. Pro-Republican captured soldiers and civilians were rounded up and killed. One famous instance is in the city of Badajoz, where Nationalist officers gathered hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of Republican sympathizers in the bullring of the city and slaughtered them with machine gun fire. The heads of the Spanish Republic were slow to respond to the insurrection. They dragged their feet in arming workers' militias that volunteered to fight. The government seemed to not fully understand that this wasn't just an uprising that they could quickly crush. It was becoming a full-on civil war. And for Francisco Franco, these early months of the war had many strokes of good luck. José Sanjurjo, who was expected to take over Spain after the rebellion, died in a plane crash in the fall of 1936. Emilio Mola, who organized the revolt, was out of favor with the Falange, and this elevated Franco to the leader of the Nationalist forces. Eventually, Mola himself would die in a plane crash, ensuring that Franco would be fully in control should the Nationalists win. But it wasn't inevitable that the far right would win the Spanish Civil War. There was a question of where to get arms, supplies, and soldiers for both the Republican and Nationalist forces. In general, most countries did not want to get involved, at least not directly. Remember, this is shortly after the Great War. Millions died in a conflict that most people across Europe and America now regarded as a waste of young lives. Plus, most of the world was recovering from an economic depression. Intervening in a civil war in Europe was not a top priority for many world leaders. All the great powers of Europe signed a non-intervention pact to declare neutrality in the war in 1936. In France, Socialist Prime Minister Léon Blum had recently been elected on a popular front of his own. His sympathies were with the Republic. But officially, he was neutral. Any strong moves could incite the right-wing forces at home and plunge France into a civil war of its own. Blum's government provided safe passage for arms and volunteer troops making their way to Republican Spain, but it couldn't do this out in the open. The U.S. recognized the Republic as the legal government, but they remained neutral. In fact, Congress passed several neutrality acts during the conflict that specifically banned the arms trade to Spain, although there were a few loopholes to this, as we'll discuss later. Many thousands of Americans did fight for the Spanish Republic in the war, though. They did this through international volunteer brigades, such as the Lincoln Battalion. The Lincolns were American volunteers who were part of the International Brigades. This was a volunteer project run by the Communist International. However, these brigades had no official U.S. government backing. Any serious material support for the Republic came from the USSR, although I should note that Mexico also sent weapons to the Republican side. The Soviet Union was a huge source of both military equipment and advisors to Republican Spain, which would have an increasing level of influence as the war dragged on. Although they signed the non-intervention agreement, the Soviets began to breach the treaty more and more as the fascist powers broke the deal on their end. Fascist Italy and Nazi Germany were both staunchly on the side of the nationalists. Involvement in the Civil War was almost an obsession with Mussolini, who committed hundreds of planes and tanks as well as over 50,000 troops directly to Franco's cause. Italy also had one of the largest submarine fleets in the world, which it used to sink vessels carrying precious supplies and troops to Republican ports. Adolf Hitler sent the Nationalists tanks and some soldiers, but most importantly, he sent them the bombers of the Condor Legion. Hitler had already secretly used transport planes to carry Franco's army across the Strait of Gibraltar from Africa. But the Condor Legion was a much more elaborate intervention in the war. It was an experimental unit based around the doctrine of combined arms. Four squadrons of bombers were supported by fighters, and two armored units, and four tank companies. The Legion would punch through Republican lines with the tanks and heavily bomb populated areas in Republican Spain throughout the war. But all those bombers, fighters, tanks, and submarines need fuel. But not many reporters in Spain at the time put too much thought on where Franco's army was getting it. And the answer was Texaco. This brings us to the main character behind our criminal conspiracy for this episode. He was a man named Torkild Reber. He was the head of Texaco at the time of the war. Reber's career started at age 15. He was a young Norwegian immigrant, working as a mariner on a fast clipper ship that sailed around the tip of South America from San Francisco to New York. He also worked on vessels that carried indentured workers from India to sugarcane fields in the Caribbean. By the time he gained his American citizenship, Reber was in command of an oil tanker. When his tanker got bought up by Texaco, he started working in the corporate office. By 1935, Torkild Reber would be chairman. Texaco was known as an aggressive, take-no-prisoners corporation in the oil business. The founder had a black skull and crossbones flag flying above the corporate office. It would be a company well-suited to a man like Torkild Reber. Reber was a gregarious person, strong, stocky, full of stories from his interesting past lines of work, and he used this charisma to earn the praise of American publications, even while he openly expressed a fondness for European dictators. Everybody knew that Torkild Reber was pro-Nazi, although he would dismiss any accusations that this was out of racism, saying, quote, "Some of my best friends are goddamn Jews." One friend of Reber's would later defend him, claiming that his association with fascist dictators was just a business decision. Quote, "He said with an autocrat, you really only have to bribe him once. With democracies, you have to keep doing it over and over again." But if he was just trying to make money off of fascism, Torkild Reber's actual business decisions don't make much sense. Before the military junta in Spain, Texaco was the main supplier of oil to the Spanish Republic. But as soon as the military revolt broke out, Reber canceled the contract, switching out a huge delivery of fuel and oil meant for the legitimate government of Spain over to the nationalist side. It turned out that Torkild Reber was close friends with a man named José Antonio Álvarez Alonso, an official from Spain's government oil company. Álvarez Alonso had met Reber during a tour of Texaco's pipeline terminal some years earlier. He was also a member of the Falange, remember, that's Spain's fascist party that supported Franco. Shortly after the nationalist insurrection, Álvarez Alonso went to France, where he established contact with Reber's official in Paris. Reber came to meet Álvarez Alonso personally and pledged his support to the nationalist cause. When Álvarez Alonso returned to Spain, he telegrammed to Reber that the nationalist government needed Texaco oil, but it had no tankers to transport it, and no money to pay for it. Torkild Reber immediately telegrammed a reply to Franco's government. Don't worry about payments. Reber was soon invited to Burgos in Spain, the capital of the Nationalist forces. And there, he worked out a sweetheart deal for the Nationalists. Since all of Spain's gold reserves were in Republican hands, the Nationalists had to pay for Texaco products on credit. On paper, Nationalist Spain would have 90 days to pay for oil shipments, but in reality, this was never stringently enforced. One Spanish official said about Texaco's oil sales, quote, "We paid what we could, when we could, and the debt went well over the established limit." Texaco would also be the Nationalist purchasing agent, so if they didn't have a product that the military needed on hand, they would buy it from other suppliers and ship it to Franco. This very generous credit arrangement was all backed by a guarantee from Juan March, who is Spain's richest man and a staunch supporter of the Nationalists. But remember, Nationalist Spain didn't have any oil tankers either. No problem, since Reber promised them that all the deliveries would come on Texaco vessels, free of extra charge. All of the oil shipped to Franco's forces from Texas was priced as if it came on Spanish ships, but in fact, the fleet was all American. Now, pretty much everything that Texaco worked out with Nationalist Spain was a flagrant violation of U.S. law. Congress passed multiple neutrality acts restricting the sale of arms or supplies to countries at war, with one law in 1937 explicitly covering Spain. For one, it was illegal for Texaco to offer oil to Franco on credit. The law forbade extending credit to nations that were at war. The Neutrality Acts had some loopholes. Airplane fuel and oil was not restricted for sale to warring countries. Texaco alone supplied more than twice the amount of oil to the Nationalists than Republican Spain was able to source from the entire world. And things like trucks and tires, even if they were being used for military purposes, were not considered arms under the law. And companies like General Motors and Firestone made a lot of money stocking up Franco's supply lines. But what was illegal was shipping supplies like these on American vessels. Clearly, Texaco was doing this for the Nationalists, and on full credit. However, Torkild Reber worked out a clever way to hide it from the authorities. While Texaco tankers were docked at home in Port Arthur, Texas, their official ship's manifest would declare that they were bound for neutral European ports like Rotterdam or Amsterdam. But once the vessel was at sea, the ship's captain would open a sealed document containing secret orders. The ship would then change course to Spain. Falsifying a ship's manifest like this is illegal, and it was the only way that Texaco was able to build that vital lifeline for Francisco Franco. So why were they able to get away with it? We have to remember that in the 1930s, the U.S. government getting involved in a war in Europe was not a popular position, and it makes sense why. World War I was a pointless slaughter, and the country was still recovering from the fallout of the Great Depression. Like Leon Blum in France, President Franklin Roosevelt had personal sympathies for the Republican cause that were no secret, but he couldn't, or wouldn't, go too far out of his way to act on them. Part of this was because the upper hierarchy of the Catholic Church supported the Nationalists. Atrocities committed against clergy in Republican Spain, as well as the Church's favored position in the traditional Spanish hierarchy, ensured that they would back the right wing of the conflict. Public opinion in the U.S. was generally behind Republican Spain, but that was only among people who had any opinion on the war at all. Most people just didn't care. One group who did care about the conflict were Catholic newspapers and bishops in the United States, all of which, by this point, were solidly behind Franco. The anti-Semitic demagogue, Father Coughlin, had a huge radio audience. He used this to propagandize for the Nationalists. Catholics were a huge part of the Democratic voting bloc, and Roosevelt wanted to avoid kicking that hornet's nest. Still, he did express private sympathy for the Spanish Republicans. He hosted supporters like the writers Ernest Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn at the White House. FDR was interested in the cause of a democratic Spain, but he feared that the American public needed to be prodded into supporting it before he acted. After hearing a speech from a pro-Republican lobbyist at Roosevelt's home in Hyde Park, The president called out, quote, "I cannot hear you. I can hear the Roman Catholic Church and their allies very well. They speak very loudly. Could you and your friends speak a little louder too, please?" The policy of the U.S. towards Republican Spain would remain officially neutral. But all the while, an American petroleum company was supplying the nationalists and their fascist allies with the majority of their oil. Thanks to Texaco, the nationalists in Spain had an endless supply of motor oil and fuel to power their tanks, ships, and planes as they fought to overthrow the democratically elected government of the country. Let's take a look at a few specific things that the nationalists did with that fuel. In the summer of 1937, Italian submarines ambushed a passenger ship called the Ciudad de Barcelona, 20 miles off the coast of Catalonia. The ship was traveling from Marseille to Spain, carrying volunteer troops for the international brigades. 50 of those recruits drowned. Just in August of that year, the Italian and nationalist navies would sink 26 ships carrying supplies or troops to Republican Spain. And now that the fascists had mastery of the sea, the Soviet Union would have to ship cargo to France, where it would make a long journey overland to the Spanish Republic. Texaco products also helped the fascists win the battle from the air. In northern Spain lies the Basque Country, a proud, independent region where many speak a language unrelated to Spanish. In fact, the Basque language is unrelated to any other in the world. This area was conservative, and it was far more religiously Catholic than most of Spain. However, thanks to the nationalist policies against regional autonomy, much of the Basque Country sided with the Republican side. Around the port city of Bilbao, the Basques built the Ring of Iron, a labyrinth of fortifications and artillery positions. The region was also mountainous. It could have been very difficult for the nationalists to assault if they didn't have a well-supplied air force. The Condor Legion of Nazi Germany was a new breed of military unit that brought air and ground forces together under one command. Nazi officers were eager to experiment with the effects of modern aerial warfare, and the people of the Basque Country would be their test subjects. In March of 1937, German aircraft attacked the country town of Durango. It bombed the Church of Santa Maria in the middle of Mass, and it destroyed the local convent, then flattened the rest of the sleepy village with machine gun fire and bombs. All in all, they would kill 248 civilians in Durango. But this wouldn't even be the most famous attack by the Condor Legion in Basque Country. The following month, on the afternoon of April 26, 1937, the church bells began to ring out an alarm in the city of Guernica. It was a market day, which meant that the small city was crowded with farmers from across the region. Soon, German Heinkel and Junker medium bombers appeared over the city, dropping high-explosive incendiary bombs, each one weighing up to 1,000 pounds, and spraying civilians with machine gun fire in the streets, as well as mowing down any who tried to flee on the outskirts of the city. The bombers attacked Guernica in waves for nearly 4 hours, and by the time they were finished, the Luftwaffe had killed 1,654 civilians in one evening, with 889 wounded. Attacks like these shocked millions of people worldwide. Guernica is still remembered today as one of the first wartime atrocities committed by the Nazis, and they carried it out thanks to fuel supplied on credit by Texaco. The constant bombing of the Basque Country would help the nationalists break the Ring of Iron by the summer of 1937. The Republic was driven from the north of Spain. Although Torkild Reber did his best to supply credit and free shipping to the nationalists in secret, he was eventually found out. Customs agents in the U.S. discovered that Texaco was falsifying their ship manifests. Around the time the Nazis were bombing the Basque Country, Reber got a visit from the FBI. Reber assured them that he was doing legal commerce with a foreign government that he was certain would win the war. He just wanted to bet on the right side. Certainly the FBI could see that that wasn't illegal. The Justice Department opened a case, and they quickly got proof that Texaco was falsifying ship records and violating the Neutrality Act. Still, the Justice Department official in charge of the case was hesitant to take on such a big company. He wrote to the Attorney General, notifying him that he should try the case in New York, since that's where Texaco's corporate headquarters were. But he added in his memo to the AG, quote, "In view of the prominence of some of the offenders, you might wish to know of the matter before the case is submitted." According to the Neutrality Act, Torkild Reber could have been sent to prison for up to 5 years, and the Justice Department had proof that he personally broke the law. Nevertheless, Texaco would only be fined $22,000. This is a light slap on the wrist for illegally supplying most of the oil used by nationalist forces in Spain. Most of this would be public knowledge shortly after the Spanish Civil War ended. It was not a secret that Torkild Reber liked the fascists. But the American press, who had reporters embedded in Spain during the conflict, were silent on the issue at the time. We know for a fact that at least one reporter, William Carney of the New York Times, knew almost everything that was going on between Texaco and nationalist Spain and refused to publish anything about it. Records from Torkild Reber's Paris office show that Carney was well associated with Texaco's operatives in Europe. One letter from a Texaco official in Paris was sent to the head of nationalist Spain's oil company. In the letter, the operative from Texaco refers to Carney as, quote, "a good friend of mine," and asks the oil executive to meet with Carney over dinner. The letter from Texaco also claimed about Carney, quote, "of all newspaper correspondents, he has done so far the most effective propaganda for the cause in the American press." Although it's almost certain that reporters from major outlets had knowledge of Texaco's under-the-table dealings with the nationalists, the only contemporary American outlet that reported on it at the time was rather small. It was the newspaper for the industrial workers of the world, often called the Wobblies. One of their members helped crew a Texaco tanker. He found out about the ship's destination firsthand and alerted the union's newspaper editor. But generations later, historians would discover that there was even more to Texaco's involvement with Franco and his allies. In recent years, a Spanish scholar named Guillem Martinez Molinos discovered some more interesting details about Texaco while he was poring over the archives of Spain's oil monopoly. Texaco was doing far more than just supplying the nationalists with fuel. They were also spying for them. You see, having a huge network of oil tankers crossing the oceans and docking in ports all over the world means that you have a lot of eyes out there. Captains of Texaco vessels, or Texaco employees across Europe, would pass along information about ships bound for Republican Spain. Everything from ship destinations, cargo, to details of the ship's crew were gathered, and this intelligence was consolidated in Texaco's Paris office and then passed on to the nationalists. As a result, Italian submarines and Spanish and German bombers always seemed to know where Republican supply ships were headed well before they reached port. The damages to the Republican merchant marine were tremendous. In one example, Texaco helped the nationalists capture a critical supply vessel that was headed to restock the Republican enclave in northern Spain. In July 1937, the Texaco office in Paris sent a telegram to nationalist headquarters in Burgos. It alerted the nationalists about a suspicious black-painted vessel called the Campo Amor, docked in southern France. Texaco's employees knew the captain, and they also knew that his commitment to the war was very weak. Texaco advised the nationalists, quote, "with a little persuasion, he might be induced to deliberately give himself up with his ship." It was good advice. Within 4 days, the nationalists sent a raiding party to the Campo Amor while it was still docked. They easily took over the vessel and sailed it to Spain. It held 10,000 tons of airplane fuel. By spring of 1939, Franco and the nationalists would conquer Catalonia, take Madrid, and win the Spanish Civil War. The reprisals against Republican sympathizers were just as swift as they had been during the conflict itself. It's impossible to get an exact number of just how many people the Nationalists killed after the war, but historian Gabriel Jackson places it at around 200,000 executed or killed through forced labor. This is considered a high estimate, and there were serious atrocities on both sides of the war, but the cruelty of the Nationalist side was unmatched. Nearly every serious historian admits that the Nationalists killed far more prisoners and civilians than the Republicans did. What followed was almost 40 years of a right-wing dictatorship. Francoism had shades of fascism, shades of monarchism and traditionalist reaction, but overall it was politically repressive, and it held Spain back for decades. Spain, once so politically divided, was now united by force under a criminal regime. As for Torquild Reber, his friendship with far-right strongmen didn't stop with Franco. After the war in Spain ended, Reber would sell oil to Nazi Germany, and he expanded his investments there. While the Nazis were invading Poland, Reber went on a tour of his German industrial holdings. He was guided by the Luftwaffe commander Hermann Göring. He even stayed at Göring's villa for a weekend during his trip. But by the summer of 1940, most of the public outside of the fascist countries of Europe finally began to agree that being close friends with Nazis was not cool. Public opinion turned against Reber. He was a man who had once so deftly courted the press with his charming tales of life as a sea captain. But finally, the board of Texaco began to confront Reber about all the trouble he was making for Texaco in the press. "My fault," said Reber. "I talk too much." To make matters worse, many of the German employees that Torquild Reber had hired turned out to be Nazi spies. Not long after the invasion of France, secret Nazi operatives in Texaco's New York headquarters were sending detailed information about American and British ships directly to intelligence units in Germany. Reber was forced to give up his position as chair of Texaco. But lucky for him, he bet on the winning hand in the last war, and he had close friends in Spain. Generalissimo Franco quickly hired Reber as the chief American buyer for the Spanish state oil company. Reber would use his wealth to move onward and upward through various executive positions in petroleum and shipbuilding for the rest of his life. Torquild Reber, supplier of Generalissimo Franco and the Nazis, died in 1968. At the age of 86, a very wealthy man who never saw the inside of a prison. This has been Conspiracy You Can Believe In. Stay tuned for a bonus episode about the Spanish Civil War with more details about the conflict and its causes. Thanks for listening.